You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 138.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. I've got a new podcast set up today, but same old co-host here. We're going to welcome Aaron to the show. Aaron, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
You know,
it's
good.
It's officially autumn now. We've made it out of the summer, so that feels like it caught me off guard. But things are good.
That's nice. I'm trying to make it through the year. I feel like, and I know that people are like, it's not like the year changes and the problems don't follow us. But I need a cutoff point. I mean,
You can't accomplish large goals without setting small benchmarks along the way. So
I guess we have the Jewish New Year right now. So that's sort of
right.
One tick. And then I feel like this is now the time when I'm like, these are the changes I want to make. And then the secular New Year is the time when I'm like, okay, this is, you know, this is when it should start.
That's not a bad model. Keeps you from getting caught off guard on New Year's Eve saying, shoot, what's my resolution? What am I going to do with myself?
No. Yeah. You have to prepare it. You have to prepare it for sure. So last week I did my first ever call-in show and I was not sure how that was going to go. I thought people were going to be like, well, what is this? This is kind of weird. Jumping from topic to topic. I actually got a few emails on that. People liked it. So maybe we should do more call-in shows.
Yeah, I thought it went well.
Yeah. You know, we talked about all sorts of things. The election, we talked about Bayes applied to COVID. And I think we'll apply Bayes to one of our topics today. We're doing science topics today. We're talking about, we're talking about cosmology. We're talking about biology. We're talking about genealogy. So this is a little bit outside our wheelhouse a little bit, but we have our toolkit.
Yeah, a little bit of pop sci.
Yeah. All right. So why don't we just get into it? I mean, the first one I wanted to talk about was an article I have linked here to the New York Post. So you can always link to various different sources, and the New York Post is always one that might be controversial, but they tend to take science topics like this and make it like a short article that appears interesting. But this is about whether there is life outside of planet Earth. And that's always been a topic of great interest to me. I feel like it's something that a lot of people are interested in. Some people probably don't care. Some people are probably like, well, what does this have to do with my life? Where do you stand on that?
I mean, I can see both sides of it. I think it would be undeniably cool. It would be kind of a mind-blowing thing if we were actually able to confirm that. But the flip side is, at least in the forms that we're discussing today, the instigating story, it's not like all of a sudden my world would be changed terms of the day-to-day. This is a far shot from, you know, little green men landing on the White House lawn saying, take me to your leader.
Yeah. No, but, you know, I feel like this is one of the slow moving areas of science where we've actually seen quite a bit of progress in our lifetime, where it's not, I feel like physics, when they're trying to make the unified theory, I mean, there's been some stuff, but they've almost kind of seemed to have hit a brick wall there in many ways. I'm sure the brick wall will dissipate at some point, but it seems like we're learning a lot about our galaxy, our universe, our solar system, and we're learning about it fast. Like every few years, there's something else. And today, it was always assumed if there's life in this solar system outside of Earth, it's got to be in Mars, where, you know, it's much colder than Earth, but it has an atmosphere.
Yeah,
and
I mean, there's been a lot of talk about Mars in that context in the last 10, 15 years.
Right, and the moons of Jupiter, where, you know, there's oceans underneath ice, where it's like, okay, we could see life there. And there has not been a lot of focus on Venus, and the reason has been because it is hot, it is dense. I mean, that planet is, if you think Mars is trying to kill you if you go there, Venus is 1,000 times worse. Like, that atmosphere will crush you, and it is toxic gas.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say it's not just toxic; it's like sulfuric acid or something. It's
so how is that worse?
I mean, you wouldn't want to breathe it, but I think even if you didn't breathe it, it would probably corrode through whatever. You need a special suit, not just to to separate you from the outside, but to keep it from eating away at you.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So Venus is definitely not somewhere you want to go. And some scientists have, and I believe this, where were the scientists? I have to look. Here's the paper in Nature Astronomy magazine, but I want to know, like, I did not look up what university it is, but this is what they're talking about. They found evidence of phosphine on Venus, not like, you know, tons of it, but enough where it's like, we don't know a way to produce that amount of phosphine in an inorganic way, you know, without microbial life. So,
yeah, and I don't remember what the source was that I read this, but I think they said that they were kind of using this as an excuse to calibrate one of their instruments. They pointed it at Venus to look for this, and they were expecting that we're going to see barely trace, if any, recognition of this particular compound. And then they found it in not just detectable, but, you know, significant beyond background, that it can't just be a measurement error levels. So
right, and
it was almost an accidental discovery.
Well, a lot of these are, and that's pretty cool. I mean, people have made the point, well, it's on Jupiter, but you kind of expect it on Jupiter because the gas giants are a little different. I mean, it's the pressure and the whatever. So I don't understand all the chemistry, but apparently this is something that they don't have. And so we have a bunch of points here. We're going to do some Bayesian probabilities on all of these points that we have. So we wrote down here three possible explanations, right? And one is it's not actually phosphine. We've detected it in error, which it's not like you could actually see the phosphine. It's, you know, they're detecting, I believe, you know, spectral evidence of it. So it's like,
yeah, well, that's how most astronomy work is done, is
yeah.
It's very hard to directly observe anything that,
I mean, imagine
even when we're discovering planets, it's often, well, we can't see the planet, but we can see that the light from the star is being affected in a way that indicates there's probably a planet there. So
one of the most mind blowing discoveries is that you could actually tell what these foreign bodies are made out of, just from data, which is pretty, people don't think about this that much, but told someone 100 years ago, if you told someone 100 years ago, that would be possible. That would be really mind blowing. So one is it's an error. Two is it's the result of a biological process. And three, it's the result of an inorganic process, chemical or geological, previously unknown. So we're not going to be very good at putting probabilities on this ourselves because we're not really in the field. But I don't even know. Do we even want to try?
Well, I'll just throw out, not putting a number on it, but kind of some context for that paper in Nature.
Yeah.
So they're putting a pretty high probability on category number two, is that it's the result of some sort of biological process. Mm. Not because they have a compelling argument for why it is that, but more that they've looked real hard at number three. Could there possibly be some sort of inorganic process that would result in what we're observing? And they've exhausted all of the ways they can think of it. And so they kind of published this paper in the context of, we can't come up with an explanation other than biological life. If you can, please, please tell us. And throwing that out to the scientific community.
Yeah, well, right. I feel like at this point I would be more inclined to accept the principles, the Cromwell principle, like don't put anything close to 0% on this. I think all three are very possible, but the fact that they're putting this out to the scientific community, you're going to see lots of alternative explanations come forward, and if none come forward over a period of time, then that result being a biological process becomes higher and higher, and the implications of that are, well, we'll talk about the implications of that, but that would be pretty far-flung implications.
And I think this could be a huge motivator for either increasing investment in exploration of our near planets, or perhaps maybe diverting some of the resources from Martian exploration, which certainly not the prime motivator, but one of the motivators has been we think there might be trace signs of life there to go explore that. That if we think there might be a payoff of a similar magnitude on Venus, that maybe we should start sending robotic missions there as well. So that could be very cool.
I mean, I feel like it's a lot harder. Like you said, it corrodes the, you know, we have vehicles driving around on Mars. We're not going to have vehicles. Well, can we have vehicles driving around on Venus? I think maybe we do have something, but it's...
So there would be two things on that front. Yeah. I don't know when the last probe was sent to Venus, but they have sent probes, and it is very much, I believe, one of those scenarios that you can send it in, but it will eventually, kind of burn up in the atmosphere, not just because of friction, like when we deorbit satellites, but because of the corrosive nature and the harsh environment. However, if we step back to Mars for a minute, there is a mission that is en route to Mars right now, which has a small helicopter as part of it, which will be the first time that we've tested flying essentially an aircraft.
That'd be freaking awesome.
On another planet.
Like a drone on Mars.
And if they can learn some lessons from that, we may be able to extrapolate to having some sort of atmospheric craft for Venus, which... It also sounds like signs of life are not on the surface of Venus, the surface of Venus being close to 900 degrees Fahrenheit, that they suspect if there is this sort of biological process occurring, that it's up at like 50, 60 kilometers into the atmosphere, where it's more between, room temperature and boiling water. So
that's Venus cold.
Yeah. So if we were looking to explore the origins of this particular phenomenon, we wouldn't want to be going down to the surface anyway. So certainly not an easy challenge, but I would put money on the folks at JPL being able to come up with a way to do it.
So is there anything in your area of expertise where you would know something about designing aircraft on other planets? Because I know you know something about designing aircraft, but...
not really. And that's actually so. There is a related Metaculus question about the Martian helicopter, and folks are pretty bullish about it in general. However, there is a significant non-zero chance that it fails completely because we're very limited in ways we can test for how
on Mars or Venus
behave for Mars.
Wow. Okay. So you might
they've done some testing, but it's you can maybe test in vacuum, but it's not exactly vacuum. And how do you test in reduced gravity? And it's they've tried to do some proxies, but there's serious limitations on how much they can prove it out beyond actually going and doing it. So
okay, yes, I do know something in a while, more than the average person.
I think they were putting the odds at something like mid 60% for success of the Martian helicopter. Now that may have been partially mitigated by the caveat and you could do a Bayesian breakdown on this in order to get to the point where you launch and try and fly the aircraft off of the rover. You got to get there, so you got to build in all the chances of failure of the mission up to that point as well.
Well, it looks like there's a good what is the name of that mission?
That is an excellent question.
I'm gonna try to look at it. I'm sorry about these notifications. I can't turn them off. New computer. here it is. First interplanetary helicopter on its way to Mars. NASA's Ingenuity of Mars helicopter launched with the Perseverance rover it launched on July 30th. Scheduled to land in February of next year. So we'll maybe revisit that in February. So that will be that'll be fun. Oh my God, this URL is so crazy. Lots of %20s. hey, that's what we're talking about. So I'm glad that we're talking about things that are happening outside the planet today, because the planet is so messed up. So we're talking about the right
thing. Here we go. I found the Metaculus question.
Yeah.
And the community prediction is at 80% chance of success, and apparently. I put it at 85, but for our listeners, that question is closed, so it's too late to get in a forecast now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, right. So let's talk about why it would be a big deal if we found life on Venus. Well, first of all, finding life outside of Earth would be a big deal. But let's say we found it on Venus instead of Mars. I feel like there's an extra big deal in that because the conditions are so harsh. Or, I mean, harsh maybe is not the right word because that's just harsh relative to us, right? I mean, you know, if you're a Venusian, then Earth might look pretty harsh. But it's so different that it means that the ability for life to survive in different environments, the intelligence of it, is way higher than we could have imagined.
Well, yeah, we have a handicap in this kind of analysis because we are aware of a single case where we found life. And so it's unclear whether that means that life can only exist in a very narrow set of circumstances, which
right, but we keep
Earth
finding
falls within, or if we're just one of many cases.
Right. We keep finding life on Earth in more and more extreme environments on Earth. You know,
yeah, like, that was the other piece that I was gonna comment on that.
Right.
That, I know we've said that these conditions on Venus are fairly extreme, and I don't know if we've mentioned, but it sounds like it's an abiotic process, most likely. So, So it's
abiotic.
What I want to say is it's not necessarily oxygen based.
Right. Okay.
So there are organisms on the planet Earth that have non oxygen based cycles. There are some microbes and bacteria that live in like undersea volcano vents where pretty extreme conditions, both in terms of pressure and temperature. But I don't know off the top of my head how that compares to the conditions on Venus. So whether this would be, like an order of magnitude difference, or if this is in that same band, but we are questioning whether life could kind of originate there, or if it has to originate in a much more moderate condition and then it can kind of adapt into the more extremes. So there's a lot of unknowns there. It's hard to generalize from a case of one.
Right, right. So, and I guess the point I want to make, the way I'm thinking about it is, okay, we see life in more and more extreme conditions on Earth. Is it going to come to a point where it's like, well, you could get to this extreme, but no more extreme than this because, will we at some point find the limit, or we at some point say, oh no, it's actually we're actually going to keep finding life in more and more extreme environments. I mean, look, there are places on Earth. Well, I don't know, what is the status of life in, like, say, Antarctica? Is that all? Is the snowy surface of that all lifeless? Probably not, right? I'm a little bit outside.
Certainly not.
Yeah.
Although it is, I know they've done. They work hard to keep from quote unquote contaminating it with too much outside influence. But even if humans hadn't made their way to Antarctica, I mean, there are penguins there.
Well, sure. I'm talking about though, kind of like microbial life.
Yeah, there must be. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got to be everywhere. Okay. So
the word I was looking for wasn't abiotic; it was anaerobic.
Anaerobic. So, okay, like aerobics, working out. You're
yes. So anaerobic,
you're breathing in oxygen, and
is the non-oxygen phase. Of
that. Okay. Okay. Makes you look at aerobics a whole new way. All right. So let's also talk about like what that means in terms of life in the galaxy in general, or life nearby. So first of all, one thing that we could find is that life is just so extremely rare, and it turns out that every time we find evidence on Mars and Venus and all these places, it turns out to be a false alarm, which is possible. That's still a possibility there. And so if it turns out that these are all false alarms, as soon as the more and more we find that to be the case, the more it looks like, wow, life is very rare, in which case it might not be very common. In our galaxy, even if life exists elsewhere in the universe, you'd have to travel really far and it would be unlikely to get them. Now, it could also be that life is very rare, but it exists in many places in the solar system because of the panspermia hypothesis. That is a strange one, but that one says that okay, life is extremely, extremely rare, but it originated one place in the solar system and somehow could travel from planet to moon to asteroid within the solar system. I kind of find that hard to believe, but that has not been falsified, has it?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to disprove, but there's been a lot of discussion of that, in particular in the context of our explorations of Mars, right. With the concern, well, if we find signs of life on Mars, does that mean that life actually originated there, or is it just that that somehow life from Earth managed to make its way to Mars, in the form of comets or some sort of ejecta? We know that there, or we
like
we
a believe volcano.
The moon was basically split off from Earth during a large collision, and so who's to say that when all that material was
so basically
broken off, that some of it couldn't have ended up going into an orbit that eventually took it to Mars.
So it's got to be something like a very simple life-bearing molecule.
Right. We're not talking about like gremlins hitching a ride.
Yeah. Or like I was thinking
bacteria level stuff.
I was thinking of chipmunks building a little rocket ship, maybe about 3 feet tall, and like getting in them, or beavers.
As adorable as that might be, that seems highly unlikely.
Yeah. So I don't know about that one. I'd have to look into that.
Yeah. And the other thought there is that even if it makes it very if you give some credence to this hypothesis, it makes it difficult to determine the directionality of that as well. That who are we to say that there wasn't at one time life on Mars, and that's where the life on Earth came from?
Right, we're all Martians.
The bacteria on there has since died out, but that was the source for the seeding of Earth.
Right. All right. So let's the third hypothesis here, which is the craziest one, is let's suppose that we discover, I don't know how, if this can be proved definitively, but let's say we have independent creation of life on both Earth and Venus, or even on both Earth and Mars, and we discover that it's very likely to have been created independently. That is the implications of that are hard to, overstate the implications of that, because if life was started independently in two different places in the solar system, that means it is unimaginably abundant in our galaxy. Like, it's like Star Trek. You go to almost every star, and there'll be
the possible counter to that would be, and I think you can poke holes in this pretty easily.
Yeah.
But what about the possibility that, okay, yeah, so life can fairly easily spawn in our solar system, but there's something special about our solar system that makes it unique among all the stars.
But like what? I mean, could be.
I guess much of our search for life in the galaxy has been based around looking for Earth-like planets, which I think a fundamental starting point for that is looking for sun or for soul-like stars as well.
We found both.
So I guess the question is, how narrowly do you define the band of properties around the special case that is our solar system to distinguish it from others? That I think that constraint kind of quickly falls apart. I would find it much harder to believe that there's something uniquely special about our solar system that makes it impossible for life to have occurred in around other stars.
Yeah, I still think it's possible that we won the life lottery. You know, like it's just life is very uncommon, and somehow we won the lottery. So yes, if it's shown that life can be independently created, then we have, we know there are a lot of planets. We know there are a lot of Earth-like planets, sun-like stars. So that's almost crazy to think about. Three possibilities. Let's see what we can say about subjective probabilities on those. I'm not saying Bayesian, I'll say subjective, because I don't know how this would update it, but certainly it would mean independent creation, I think, goes up.
So just setting some baseline rules. We're talking about these three possibilities. Presumably they have to sum up to less than or equal to 100%.
Right. So the one is no life elsewhere in the solar system. Two is life on solar system with a single origin caused by panspermia. And three is independent creation of life on various planets or, you know, moons count, like bodies in the solar system. So right now, I mean, I feel like, I mean, can this get answered in our lifetime? I don't know. I feel like only the only one that could be falsified in our lifetime is the no life elsewhere. That could be.
Yeah. And even that is a challenge.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's we're working hard to try and answer that question on Mars. And that's one of the easier ones to address. Oh, that was the other thing I wanted to throw out there about the Mars versus Venus question is I'm not familiar enough with the orbital mechanics, but I know a big challenge for Mars is that it takes, you know, somewhere between like 18 months and 3 years to do a trip to Mars, depending on where you are. Yeah. In our orbit cycles. I don't know if a mission to Venus would be
I believe
more
shorter.
Convenient from that perspective.
I mean, think so, yeah.
I think they may be closer, but there's more complexity to that question than just how close the orbits are.
I mean, under the impression that they're way closer, and also the planets are way closer in size, although that doesn't help when you have a planet, you know, engulfed in flaming sulfur or whatever. The worst possible. Okay, so, yeah, no, I think with this discovery, the Bayesian posterior for independent creation of life has ticked up. I don't know exactly where it is, but it looks like the discoveries over the last 20 years has caused, if there were a betting market, would cause the probability for independent creation of life to tick upward and upward. Now, that doesn't mean that it's, you know, sometimes you have discoveries going in one direction and then all of a sudden it all gets overturned. But that appears to be the direction that we're going in here, which is exciting, I don't know, terrifying.
Yeah, well, and part of it is kind of the difficulty of proving the null hypothesis here, that the more information we gather, the more opportunities we have for finding promising data.
Sure.
Whereas when we continue to make observations that don't suggest the presence of life, that doesn't really push the probability down so much as it continues to keep us kind of at our steady state level. That's already been kind of baked into our predictions at that point, I would say.
Yeah. So I don't know what my subjective probability on independent creation is, but maybe, I don't know, I probably would not put it at 50%. I might put it at a bit lower, 20%. But I'm just pulling that number out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's the one I most want to be true.
I guess
but,
so.
But yeah,
I mean, it's I, like I feel like I want it, but then I'm like, do I really want it? I don't know. Right. So if there's life everywhere, then there's this concept of the great filter, which I have to mention because it's always a good discussion to have at like 1-2 in the morning, which is like, well, where are all if life is everywhere, where are all these intelligent civilizations that we can see?
Yeah.
Evidence?
So yeah, the great filter is really just a building extrapolation off of the Drake equation, right?
Right, and the Drake equation is the one that's like, what's the probability of an intelligent of an intelligent species on another planet? And like one of them when he made it was like, well, what percentage of stars have planets? And for all they knew at the time, it could be like, you know, one out of a million. Well, now we know it's, you know, almost all of them. So that changes over time quite a bit.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I think the Drake equation is involved, but I guess is the Fermi paradox the other? I think that's just a restatement of the.
Yeah, it's the Fermi paradox.
If there is intelligent life, why haven't we seen it?
Right, right. And so the idea is, well, there's this great filter that prevents life from getting to a certain area. I don't know where it is. Is it the fact that maybe like, yeah, simple life is easy, but the multicellular level is near impossible, and we won the lottery on that? Is it that most civilizations blow themselves up? Is it that there's a very brief period that we're in now, and then you get so far advanced that you're not even on the same plane of, you know, you're not even on the same, we don't even know what to look for, it's so advanced type of a thing. you know, it's all that's an open question.
Yeah, I mean, there's you could make a great case for the discovering how to split the atom and entering the nuclear age is a form of the great filter, that no civilization can be expected to survive long enough past that to actually get off their planet.
Yeah, I don't buy that one. I mean, I know
it makes for an interesting discussion, but
yeah,
it's
I feel very, like it's too, it's like too mired in current events, and it's like on the geologic scale, wouldn't we find evidence of that? I guess we wouldn't at this point, but you know, we would eventually find evidence of that. I just feel like it's too, the hypothesis is too wrapped up in like basically physicists looking at current events and trying to fit it in there and trying to make a political statement.
It's hard not to, because we have little to draw on in terms of the extinction of intelligent species. Again, we've got a kind of a sample size of one issue here. I mean, you can try and draw some analogies and say, well, you know, nations or forms of government have only lasted how long without, you know, undergoing complete collapse or revolution and reformation. But to extend that metaphor to life itself is a pretty thin cloth to work with.
There. Yeah. No, I happen to think, I don't know, I happen to think there's probably some filter before us and some after us. You know, and I think before us, meaning like, okay, it's like, what if the dinosaurs didn't die out? Would there be intelligent life? Maybe not. I don't know. And so probably not. So it's maybe just the evolution of it is very, very hard. And then also I feel like we are, you know, where's humanity in 1,000 years? Not even a million, you know, assuming we're still around, you know, it's such a different, it ends up becoming such a different form of biology. Maybe it's not biology at all. Maybe it's just, maybe it's just machines, you know?
Because civilization as we know it only goes back, what was it, about 10,000 years ago that we started domesticating animals and taking up stationary agriculture isn't the right term for it, but basically building cities and farms as opposed to being hunters and gatherers.
Right.
10,000 years is like nothing. I don't even know how we would extrapolate that, especially when you look at where we were 100 years ago compared to where we are technology wise.
Right. Right. I mean, it is kind of staggering. And the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, I believe, does have an Earth-like planet. That was one of the biggest findings over the last few years. So that's pretty crazy. Only 4 light years away.
Yeah. And I don't know if they've explicitly put it in terms of the great filter, but I know that many of the people who talk about establishing off-world colonies, you know, going to Mars, building a moon colony, going, you know, to other stars eventually, they're looking at this from the perspective of, we don't all want all our eggs in one basket, because if right now, if we screw something up on Earth, whether or even if it's not something in our power, you know, if another dinosaur killer comet comes along, there is no,
I mean, those are so
no
rare.
Backup copy.
Yeah. True.
That if we've got a Mars colony, a moon colony, and we start, you know, going beyond out of the solar system, that perhaps that is a way of getting past the great filter. So, you know, when we nuke the Earth or whatever happens, that's not game over.
But I feel like
it sounds a little wacko to talk like that, but that's certainly something going on in the back of the minds of people like Elon Musk.
But if people establish colonies off world over the next 100, 200 years, then this idea of, you know, civilizations inevitably blowing themselves up, I feel like just becomes so much less likely. I just feel like it's not inevitable. I mean, we've seen it's not inevitable. Even if it happens tomorrow, it's like, well, we lasted 80 years with splitting the atom. So could somebody have lasted 300? Why not?
Yeah, but it's a probabilities game because,
yeah,
you know, how to get to whatever the development is that basically insulates you from the downsides. How long does that take? And what are the odds of getting there without falling victim to the to the downsides. But yeah, it is that becomes very much a political current events discussion, whether it's in terms of nuclear weapons and the geopolitical concerns there, or climate change and the issues surrounding that they all kind of tie back into that same root.
Yeah. All right. So what are the I have a bullet point here. What's the practical implications? I'm kind of drawing a blank, but I just think I just always like to see these stories, especially when, especially during times when we're so focused on the current time and place, and it becomes difficult to expand our minds. But yeah. So
I would say in the short term, little or none. I would be so excited if so we're recording on the 26th right now of September. Yeah. I believe we have a presidential debate coming up on the 29th. So this episode will release before that.
Yes.
My mind would be blown if they talk about this in the presidential
debate. Well, we already know the topics, so I don't think knowing Trump and Biden, you never know.
I think I would feel pretty comfortable in betting 100-to-1 odds that it's not going to be a topic of the debate.
Let me tell you, the Space Force, we're going to send them to Venus. It's going to be unbelievable.
But if we're looking a few years, maybe a decade out, I think, like we said, there could very likely be a resurgence in probes and other robotic and scientific exploration to Venus pursuing this. And I think as a lifelong space geek, that would be super cool.
Yeah. All right.
Exactly what form that takes remains to be seen.
Yeah. All right. This is kind of an unrelated science topic, but it's also, related to genetics and genealogy, which is another interesting thing, and another thing that can kind of bring us all together with, the realization that the world is often a lot more, multi-ethnic, diverse, complicated than one might assume. And so this was an article in the New York Times, which I think their science section is still good, is it? I mean, sometimes. I don't know. I can't keep up. No, but this is I thought it was interesting that the Vikings, there was a DNA study on the Vikings, and it looks like they were not just kind of Nordic people. They were almost, pan-European people. Maybe it's not too surprising that includes, Germans and Slavs, but also includes Mediterranean people as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I was surprised that this was as surprising as at least the New York Times took it to be. Because we do have evidence of Viking expeditions, perhaps more for trading than for raiding, having made it to the Mediterranean. But it was unclear how much that was kind of one-offs versus something that happened fairly frequently. And certainly our popular culture conception of Vikings is purely something of Scandinavia, your classic blonde hair, blue-eyed, 6'6", wears horned helmets and carries a sword or an axe. The horned helmet thing, I think, has been somewhat debunked in popular culture. But the other stuff, that's very much what our perception is, not necessarily accurate. They call that a couple of things, one being that there were probably a lot more farmers than Viking raiders, or at least farming was a key part of their lifestyle.
Not everyone could be a raider.
Yeah, well, and that's certainly, you don't hear epic sagas of Eric the farmer. It doesn't make for a great tale.
No.
So it's easy to focus on the more
Eric the podcaster.
but also that genetically they were more diverse in moving away from that blonde hair, blue eyed stereotype. I think interestingly that there was more mixing with other cultures. One they call out is the Sami. I'm very likely mispronouncing it, but that's a group that is even further north than the classic Vikings, famous as kind of reindeer herders up in Lapland, as well as, like you said, folks from modern day Russia and the other Baltic states and down into mainland Europe and even the Mediterranean. people got around back then. It wasn't easy. There weren't airplanes, there weren't cars, but boats got around pretty well, and you could still walk over land pretty far. And it's easy to dismiss that people actually did that, because it would be unbelievable for anyone other than a college student on a gap year to hike across Europe these days.
Well, one thing that you learn from genealogy maybe it's not surprising for a lot of people, but it's something to think about, is just how connected we all are. If you go back 1,000 years, most of the I think it's something like 1,000 years, maybe a little more. Most of the people, if I traveled in time 1,000 years in the past, most of the people living there are going to be either my direct ancestor or a direct ancestor's sibling or cousin. So it is even people who are far outside of where I would think my genetic ancestry comes from, just because if you go back in time, your number of ancestors increases exponentially until it fills up the whole of humanity. And so it is it doesn't mean that we're not genetically diverse. We are, but we all have little bits of everything. I'm sure. I mean, look, I do genealogy. Most of my ancestors are Eastern European Jews, Ashkenazi Jews. But I'm sure if I go back 1,000 years, there are some Vikings in there.
Yeah, I've only heard this second or third hand, so I don't know if there's research to back this up, the genealogy work. But I think someone told me that all Ashkenazi Jews are sixth cousins or closer. That
really? Well, that's what do you believe that?
It seems plausible.
Okay. Well, then wait a minute though. So you have some ancestors that are Ashkenazi Jewish, right? So yes. That means that we would be sixth cousins or closer.
It seems very probable, because sixth cousins is pretty far.
Well, hold on.
When you really map it out.
I guess so. I don't know sixth. I have some sixth great grandparents, but not all of them.
So kind of focusing back in on the Scandinavia piece, where the genealogy is particularly fascinating, is Iceland.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're too familiar with this, but Iceland is pretty small.
Okay.
And it was only colonized not that long ago, during this Viking age, and the people that colonized it, it was a fairly small group. So not only do they have really good records on this going back like all the way to the original colonizers, they know what everybody on the island's relation is to everybody else. And in the modern world, they have, essentially a dating app that helps you identify, when you match up with somebody, are they too closely related for this to be okay? Because it's a serious concern in a community that inbreeding is not the right term for it. But
wouldn't you just want to make sure that they're not?
For a long time, they had a limited genetic pool there, and it's fascinating from a genealogy and a research perspective, because they have such excellent records going all the way.
So it's not enough to make sure they're not like a sibling or cousin.
I think because there's so, I think a lot of those family trees kind of converge and divide and converge and divide. So it's not necessarily as clean as a classic genealogy.
Interesting. Interesting. All right. We have a few more bullet points here. I don't know if we want to get to them that it's just reminded you of. I think these are your bullet points.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So there was talk about, getting down into the Mediterranean and people from darker skinned people having a presence in this genetic study. And it reminded me of the Varangian Guard. I'm probably mispronouncing it, but which is kind of a neat pull out from history that during the Byzantine Empire, which is the Eastern Roman Empire after the fall of the Western Roman Empire.
So let's see, when would this be? Like,
I think
eight
kind of centered around 1000 AD.
I see 7 ninth and 10th century.
Yeah, okay. So long after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, which was sacked in what, like 476, somewhere around
there? Oh, God. We could go into we could turn this into a history podcast.
But this guard, this was an elite guard unit that specifically served the emperor of the Byzantine Empire, and it was primarily made up of Vikings, of Norse individuals. So they traveled all the way down from Scandinavia and northern Russia to modern day Turkey and the Middle East to serve as the elite guards for the emperor, and kind of a neat tidbit related to that is that so many, productive, males in their prime were running off to the Byzantine Empire to seek their fortune and serve in the guard, that they changed the laws in some Scandinavian countries that you could not inherit while you were serving in, I think the term was in Greece, which was how they referred to the Byzantine Empire at the time.
Sure. So it's a Greek empire.
If you were off serving in the Varangian Guard and your father passed away, you could not inherit his lands and his wealth. So it was to try and get some of those people to actually stay home. They didn't want to lose their best and their brightest. Yeah.
Another interesting find was that old Viking warrior grave was shown to be a woman. I don't know if still...
Yeah, so this... I had thought that this was super recent, and it turns
2017.
Out they'd done some. So that was when they did the DNA confirmation.
Right.
There'd been a few years before that. The backstory is that I think it was in like the 1890s they discovered this
1889.
And they said, oh, it's a Viking warrior. We can tell from all the artifacts, yada yada yada. And then in I think the early 2000s, they went back and did some further examination of the skeleton and said this kind of looks like it might have actually been female, and there was a lot of controversy because female Viking warriors are a myth. It's all just sagas and modern politics. But in 2017, they were able to successfully extract enough DNA to definitively confirm that this person in this grave was in fact a woman. Now there's still some controversy over do all the artifacts they found buried with this woman actually confirm she was a warrior.
There's
a theory that not just a warrior, but in fact a warrior and a strategist. Mm. So there's some controversy about that, but there are several leading scholars in the field who say that this does confirm the existence of not just female warriors, but female leaders among the warrior group. So that's kind of cool that it's not just a mythology that. If there's real instances.
That is really fascinating. I feel like to wrap it all up today, I feel like there's kind of a theme here where, you look at the world and you look at the discoveries that are being made, and it just seems like the world often surprises us, and there's something uplifting about the stories that we have today where it's always science has a way of kind of fighting against our human narrow-minded nature and sort of saying, no, the world is a really interesting, crazy, diverse place. And I don't know, these stories are making me happier this year than any of the other stories.
it's a good reminder to really think twice before you put your probability of something being at zero, because
that's true too.
Reality has a way of surprising you that it may be extremely unlikely, but is it really zero? So and that may serve that may yet serve us well in our daily lives if we remember that the unexpected can still happen.
Yeah. All right, so. We haven't talked about what we want to do next week. I don't know if you have any thoughts, whether we could return to some tech topics, see what's happened in the machine learning world. We could, I still have more threads to pull on topology. I want to talk about the different shapes of spaces. again, I need to hear some feedback from the audience to get that. Or we can kind of do another news report, just more general news. Who knows? We could be doing anything next week. I have some pretty cool guests for October, but I'm taking a little break this month, and we're just going to hang out. So do you have any preferences, Aaron?
I don't know what the future holds, so I'll have to give some thought on that.
Yeah, we'll see what happens for the rest of the year. All right. That was a lot of fun. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account at Max Sklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.